Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
The trouble, as it so often does, ladies and gentlemen, appears to have begun with a tweet. Adam Olson, member of the Legislative Assembly for Saanich North and the Islands, BC Green Party, tweeted the following on March the 2nd at 5:16 p.m. He writes, "The Sartlip First Nation has been experiencing an outbreak of COVID-19, and we have been under shelter-in-place orders for weeks. I saw that. I went, wow, I had no idea. I didn't know that." Next tweet in the thread says, "As a result, all adults in the Sartlip community are being vaccinated this week. This is an important part of the provincial vaccination program to better protect Indigenous communities experiencing outbreaks." He then goes on to write in a further tweet in the thread, "I'm a member and resident of Sartlip. I will receive my vaccine on Wednesday, March 3rd, 2021. Writes, "I'm providing this information about getting vaccinated earlier than anticipated because I believe transparency is critical." He writes, "Additionally, I want to encourage all British Columbians to ensure they get a vaccine according to the public health vaccination program so we can all do our part to keep our friends and family safe in this global pandemic." I didn't realize at that point, though, that apparently the Sartlip Nation itself didn't know that he was going to make that information public when and how he did. Sartlip Nation issuing a release saying that they're disappointed and angered with the Saanich North and the Islands MLA and Nation member Adam Olson. They write, "MLA Olson recently made a public social media announcement citing Sartlip's past COVID-19 outbreak." They use the term past, which I find interesting, "and shelter-in-place order. They write that their nation strategically chose not to make public the COVID-19 outbreak status. They write, "MLA Olson has now left the community with no other option but to respond and clarify the status of our past outbreak," then quotes Chief Don Tom, "Sartlip Nation had," past tense, "an outbreak at the end of January and issued a shelter-in-place order Monday, February the 8th. They write, "Our membership's hard work to social distance and shelter-in-place was effective. To be clear," the release says, "Sartlip First Nation currently has no active cases of COVID-19. Last positive test result on Sartlip was February 6th, 2021. Adam Olson yesterday issued an apology saying that he called Chief Don Tom, gave an unreserved apology for his public communication regarding the recent public health challenges facing our community. Chief Don Tom agreeing to come on the program for a conversation. Chief of the Sartlip people, thank you for your time, Chief. Good morning.
Good morning, Adam.
Chief Tom, how did you find out about this social media post? Was it just someone sharing it with you? Was there a warning? What happened?
I follow social media, and I follow Adam. I support Adam, and he's my MLA. And I saw his post, and I was surprised. And my member saw the post as well in leadership and had concern as to our strategic direction that we chose not to make it public.
Adam Olson writes that his understanding, uses the present tense, has been experiencing an outbreak of COVID-19, and we have been under shelter-in-place orders for weeks, and yet that was not accurate. Has he explained to you why?
Well, I think, to me, that I do have issue with my MLA making announcements without consulting Sartlip, and I think the larger issue here is that we live in a world where Adam Olson has to give information so that he doesn't get backlash for getting a vaccine earlier because he lives in a First Nations community. And I would like to live in a world where he can share that information and my members don't have to worry about experiencing overt racism in the community. And what we've seen in Cowichan, Cowichan members being refused services. We've had people of business in and around here asking, is it safe to have your members coming into our businesses? So the reality that we live in is that I have to decide whether it's in our best interest to make this information public. And that's the reality that Indigenous communities are having to live with.
Was there a plan for disclosure of this information at a future date when COVID had been dealt with or that vaccination had taken place?
Well, I think if we see that racism isn't prevalent, if we look at the comment section on any of your sister companies and CFAX, the racism is very prevalent. And it's a reality that we have to navigate and pick and choose. And so, I have to look out for the well-being of our members. And with the shelter in place, it was in the The cases that we had in the community were very isolated and handled very quickly and did not spread from the homes that were affected. So this was a measure that we took place because we're a social community, and it was very effective.
Why is the vaccine necessary then? Or is the vaccination incidental to the outbreak?
The vaccine is, as you see, vaccine is being rolled out to First Nations communities right now. Mm-hmm. The remaining 22 First Nations who hadn't received the vaccine are receiving it now. So communities are rolling out the vaccine right now. Because we had cases here, we were bumped up in the queue and received the vaccine just a few days before other First Nations here on Vancouver Island.
Okay, because the way that Adam Olson wrote that statement made me understand that the vaccine was necessary to end the outbreak, have been under shelter-in-place orders for weeks in the present tense, whereas it sounds like the vaccine was coming either way. Yes, the previous outbreak did move you further up in the lineup, but not by a lot.
I think when you experience an outbreak in your community, we're certainly grateful for the opportunity to provide vaccine. And we just have to navigate our society here in British Columbia with racism. And what we've seen in Mary Ellen Trappel-Lafond's In Plain Sight report is that racism is impacting Indigenous people's lives. We see Vancouver Police Department who are doing street checks, who are disproportionately street checking Indigenous and persons of color. So the reality is that First Nations are having to navigate their way through this pandemic and also racism.
Adam Olson has apologized. Did you accept his apology?
We accept his apology, and I'm one of Adam's supporters. I was one of his nominees, and I continue to support him. I just disagree with his decision to make this public without consulting me. Ordinarily, we work in really good partnership, and on this issue, I had to go public just because of the concern that came from the general public around the safety of having Sartlet members going out into public.
Yes, because if there was an active outbreak in place, people could be more concerned than they would be being reassured that COVID had been dealt with and that there was no active outbreak at this time. I can see that.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to leave with us today?
I think First Nations are very grateful for the opportunity to receive the vaccine, and as well as other British Columbians, and I sure hope that we see more understanding of First Nations and their issues and their way of life. And I probably, much like anyone, look forward to putting this pandemic behind us and being able to be with one another soon. It's just a difficult time during the pandemic, I think, in First Nations communities and everywhere.
Absolutely. I hope everybody gets vaccinated as soon as possible. That way we don't have to wonder about matters such as this. Chief Don Tom, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Have a good day. Bye now. Don Tom, Chief of the Sartlet Nation. All right, let's take a quick break. 250-386-1161, star 1070, a free call on your wireless device. You can weigh in on anything that we've discussed in the program recently after this.
It's Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Yeah, the parks have never been safe for everybody, ladies and gentlemen. They were, well, when you say every person deserves housing, you automatically include the worst case scenarios you can imagine. And unless you build checks and balances into a system, you can expect the worst case scenarios to occur because you have said every single person is allowed to do X, Y, Z. There are people with worse records than the ones that have been discussed on these airwaves recently, right now in Beacon Hill Park. There are people with worse records than the ones that have been discussed recently who are charged with yet more offenses and are awaiting court dates with respect to those offenses. And instead of being in remand in Wilkie, they are literally living in the parks. There are some individuals who are so violent, they've actually been banned from the parks. And the city of Victoria has, it's actually an impressively sophisticated system for identifying and tracking persons who may pose a threat in terms of health and safety to their employees. Because the city of Victoria, of course, has duties to its employees, as any employer does, in terms of a workplace having minimum standards that must be met. My objection has always been that the complicated system of alerts and notifications and enhanced risk areas or elevated risk areas that the city employees can use to protect themselves, and I'm glad it exists, most of you have no idea that it even exists. Do you know where ERA1 is? I do. It's the all-weather gravel field at Beacon Hill Park. At least it was recently. Things change. But again, an ongoing understanding has been taking place about dangerous individuals residing in the parks, and the public, aside from me, has heard precious little to anything about it until it's too late. And there are people who knew better, who were tricking you, who were saying things that they either knew or ought to know were not true, to try to tell you that park was safe and tell you you should go there and tell you that, oh, don't listen to that dangerous, scary guy on the radio. I mean, after a while, it gets kind of obvious that there's a little gang that would love to discredit me. Maybe it's because they realized that I would eventually find the truth. And when I did, I would tell you, and they knew they couldn't stop that. So instead, maybe they tried to get out in front of me and convince people that I was always wrong. That seems like a disturbing scenario. And yet, here we are once again, with me saying, I told you so. And with me saying, I wish we could have avoided all this nonsense. And me saying, I wonder what else they aren't telling you. Let's go to our calls where Rick's joining us. Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm pretty good, Adam. How are you?
I actually feel vindicated, Rick, because I don't have to walk around keeping all this stuff inside anymore, wanting to tell all of you, knowing that certain burdens of proof have to be met for me to speak words on these airwaves. I actually feel pretty good today.
Good. Oh, that's good. I wanted to speak about a few things. One was, I want to address that Stephen fellow that phoned you at the end of the day yesterday that had links that he sent you about Miss Bonnie Henry.
Oh, that was John. His name was John.
Oh, John.
Yeah.
Well, I pulled up that clip, and I don't know how he could get that wrong. She simply said, and I'll paraphrase, that of the 589 deaths that we've had so far from COVID, all but two were elderly.
She meant the 28, though. There's a period in there. If you were to transcribe it, there's one sentence that ends and the other begins. Here's what she said.
Bringing the total number of people who've died in British Columbia to 587. And all but two of these people are elders and seniors.
See, the all but two refers to the day and the 28.
Today is one of the most tragic days we have had yet, where we've had an additional 28 people die from COVID-19.
So what she said is we've had an additional 28 people die of COVID-19, bringing the total number to 587, period.
Oh,
then she says,
okay,
all but two of these people, the these refers to the 28, not the 587.
Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I knew this guy was taking this way out of context.
Well, maybe the podcast that he listens to took it out of context. I think it's possible he believed what he said, because I wouldn't try to call in and try to dupe anybody like that, because people know I check. I'm sure John knows that I would check. I think that the podcast that he was listening to maybe clipped it in such a way as to make it sound like something it wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the sort of thing that fuels the ignorant and causes conspiracy theories. And that segues onto my next comment. I believe that Ben Isett's language about defunding the police and his blatant, I wouldn't go far as to say hatred to the police, but he's fueling chaos with his language.
It feels like that some days, doesn't it?
He's causing the ignorant, or the people that would be normally in conflict with the police, which would be the criminal element down there at the parks, with his speech, he's fueling it. And then he infers with his language that the community isn't in sync or doesn't follow what the police is doing, which is totally not true.
Mm-hmm.
The community is behind the Victoria Police Department.
The ones I talked to sure are, yeah.
Yeah, it's Ben Isaac that's not, and then he's inferring and putting us in his bed when I don't want to be there. You know, I don't like the language of this guy, and I really wish the province would step in and just give this guy the hook off the stage. No.
Well, here's the thing, is that he was nominated to be a member of the Victoria Regional Transit Commission on January 14th. Council sent a letter, the city sent a letter confirming that on January the 20th. Ordering Council Number 100 from the Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia appointed Charlene Thornton Joe. Charlene Thornton Joe said that she accepted the minister's request for her to join the Transit Commission. So it wasn't something that she sought out or asked for. It was something that she was offered and she accepted. The minister says that he has a high degree of confidence in Charlene Thornton Joe. Nobody will actually say that Ben Isett has been rejected at this point. I emailed him. I said, what happened? And he hasn't gotten back to me yet either. Do you think that maybe the province rejected him?
Yes, I do. I think the province sent a private little letter to Lisa Helps and said, we don't want him there, and you're going to have to find an alternative. We want Ms. Thornton Joe and put her name on that. Because I really do. I think they said, nope, there's no way. Because you remember what Mr. Horgan said about Ben Isett?
That his thoughts on that individual were not printable, among other things.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So there's no way that he wants to be partner in politics with Ben Isett in any way, shape, or form.
Well, unless they've reconciled recently, but for some reason I don't see that as a likely scenario.
His ideologies are almost crazy, yet his speech is eloquent.
He's a very gifted speaker.
He is. And so it fools people into believing his rhetoric. And his rhetoric is demonstrative.
Rick, I want to say thank you for the call. This is a set of remarks that Councillor Isett made to, on council publicly for anyone who would listen, back in April, near the beginning of the pandemic. I think this is part of what Rick's talking about. Listen for yourself, folks.
Somehow along the line, somewhere, this city lost its heart. And I think all of these institutions in this province, the City of Victoria, the province of BC, Island Health, BC Housing, opinion, and having looked at it fairly closely, is over 30 or 40 years of austerity, cutbacks, smaller government, directing public revenues to help those who need it the least, the rich hoarding more, leaving the poor to suffer more. That's how we've gotten in this mess, and somewhere along the line, this city as an institution lost its heart and became a heartless neoliberal institution.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. Well, I guess, we do make people laugh on these airwaves. That's one of the many functions that these clips can play. But yeah, I'm happy to serve the people of this city, which, by the way, has become a heartless neoliberal institution over the last 30 or 40 years. You're all a bunch of horrible people. Please vote for me. Really? Okay, that's where we are. That's what we're doing. And I'm pretty sure that it wasn't just the City of Victoria proper. Although, if you thought that the City of Victoria proper as an institution, not the city, but I mean the organization with the 1,000 employees, if you were telling anybody who would listen that was a heartless neoliberal institution, how bad would you feel if a member of that institution got threatened by somebody in a park or injured in a park? How badly would you feel if that heartless neoliberal representative of a heartless neoliberal city? See, and this is why I think that public officials should be exercising more care than they have in some cases with their language. That's just my opinion here. I think that we should all be governed in this city by people who, quite frankly, are better than me. Talk radio has a role in our society. There are certain expectations in terms of the content that you will hear. We should never be governed by talk radio, for God's sake. Somebody just say something. We should expect better from those who govern over us. They should be the pinnacle of decorum and wisdom and calmed, reasonable analysis. You want somebody barking about something? That's my job. That's what I do. I'm not responsible for governing over the lives of 90,000 human beings. If I was, I'd act a lot different than I do on these airwaves. Trust me. I think that is a big problem. That idea, that sort of narrative is a big problem and has gone a long way into causing problems in this city in the last 10 months. That's just my view. Quick break. More after this.
Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Oh, yeah, the economy is still dying. No, folks, it's not dying. We're going to save it. We do have concerns, though, which is why governments exist in terms of giving out grants where necessary, relief where necessary, assistance and supports where necessary. Further to that, the government of British Columbia is extending its grant program for small and medium-sized businesses affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. They're lowering the threshold for businesses to apply. Application deadline for the business recovery grants was set to close on March 31st. Why does that date keep coming up? It's the year end for fiscal. That's why. But the province announced Thursday that it will now be accepting applications until the end of August. Here to talk more about this, we're joined by Walt Judas, CEO of the Tourism Industry Association of BC, an industry hit particularly hard with the large curtailment of travelers during the COVID-19 pandemic. Good morning. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Adam.
What is the status of the tourism industry in British Columbia at this time?
Well, it's still struggling. No question about that. We are seeing some positive signs, but at the moment, businesses are still trying to figure out ways to keep their doors open. A lot of businesses have suggested, in fact, one recent survey that I saw showed about 66% of businesses suggest that they might not be able to operate for more than 3 or 6 months if they don't see some government support. So we're still very much in a dire situation, particularly because borders are still closed and nobody's suggesting we open them tomorrow or next month. But without the international visitation for our province, businesses will struggle again this year and many won't make it because we cannot rely on domestic visitation alone.
What impact will this change in terms of the extension of the application deadline for these business recovery grants have, in your estimation?
Overall, I think it will be good. It will be very positive. As you know, the deadline, as you alluded to earlier, is approaching, and many businesses have either not yet applied or not yet heard a response or haven't developed their recovery plan. And it's a tall order to try to get that in before the end of the month because it's a two-step process. So extending the deadline allows for the time needed to approve the applications and get the money out the door to the businesses who need it most. Importantly, though, when the initial criteria included the provision of at least a 70% drop in revenue for the months of March and April last year, that was also a tall order for many businesses, particularly those that are seasonal. So for tourism operators, by way of example, March and April aren't necessarily big revenue months anyway. So 70% wasn't feasible, not to mention there were seasonal businesses also as a part of that equation that didn't even collect any revenues in those months. So it was hard to compare month over month. Now that it's been reduced to 30% for any given month, since last March, it allows many more businesses to qualify. In fact, we originally asked for a change to 50%, and the province extended that number by an extra 20%. So I think many operators will be pleased.
Grants between $10,000, a maximum of $30,000 available to many business owners, an additional $5,000 to $15,000 available to tourism-related businesses. I'm reading here, to qualify for the recovery grant, a business must develop and submit a business recovery plan as part of the application process. Talk about the development of such a plan and how feasible it should be.
Well, really, it was a way to suggest that, look, these are businesses that are going to be viable post-pandemic. If a business was already losing money prior to the pandemic and the likelihood of them surviving for any length of time was compromised even further by the pandemic, at least having a recovery plan allowed the province to evaluate the various components to determine whether they are not or are throwing good money after bad. So that's really the notion of this recovery plan, is to make sure that the business is prepared to reopen again or open to the extent that they were before, that they had the proper health and safety protocols in place, that they had a finance plan that allowed them to earn the revenues needed to sustain the business, that type of thing. I think one of the things that we looked at originally when the criteria was first developed and the program announced last fall was we didn't think it was necessary for a business to use a consultant to develop this plan, especially an outside consultant that they hadn't ever worked before. But government did make that adjustment more recently, too, that if a business was already working, say, with an accounting firm or had a business advisor, they could use that individual as opposed to somebody that wasn't familiar with the business. So there's been some movement there as well. And in addition, the province also announced recently, too, that if you've gone through the process and you didn't meet all the criteria, you were rejected for a business grant, then at the very least, the cost that you expended on that consultant would be covered by the province. So I think there's a bit more relief by the businesses to now go through that process. That said, that has delayed many businesses from receiving the funds in short order because, as I alluded to, it's a two-step process. You apply first. If you match the criteria and the government accepts your application, then you go through the recovery strategy, development, resubmit, then you're approved and likely receive the money.
Paul Judas, CEO, Tourism Industry Association of BC, reacting to news of the deadline being extended to apply for the British Columbia government's small and medium-sized business recovery grant program. Thank you for your time. Any final thoughts?
Thank you, Adam. Really appreciate your time this morning. And I think we've made a lot of progress with this program. There still are other changes that might be required to allow more businesses to qualify, doing away with things like the maximum of 149 employees or relaxing the ownership structure. But I think the headway that we've achieved since last fall has been notable, and we appreciate government support in that. And we hope that there will be further progress and more applications that are approved in the coming days.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam.
Bye now. All right, folks, quick break. Open lines after this, 250-386-1161.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Again, nobody likes to speak ill of the dead. I speak of flaws that exist in systems. And it is a fact that the system that was constructed policy-wise, by the city of Victoria, allowed a person who pleaded guilty to the criminal offense of invitation for sexual touching of a 7-year-old girl while they were in their 50s to live in a van near the Beacon Hill Children's Farm for almost a year, potentially. And nobody had any idea or got warned. In fact, those connected with City Hall worked pretty hard last summer to tell you how safe everything is. Bring the kids. Oh, it's great. It's great. It's great. Wow, I really hate to be somebody who did all that. I look different in all this, though, now, don't I? What would you have done if you were in my position? You can't just blurt stuff like that out. If you did, one, they'd call you crazy. Two, there are certain rules regarding disclosure of information with respect to certain situations. What would you have done? I don't know. Something to think about. Anyway, I have done everything that I can to warn people that the parks are not safe. They've never been safe, and it's because the system doesn't have the specificity to identify those who I think we could all reasonably say should not be permitted to, you know, live beside a children's farm for obvious reasons, or live 8 meters away from a playground, which, by the way, is also allowed, as far as I can tell, for obvious reasons. Yeah. Just going to put that out there. Oh, by the way, thoughts and prayers to politicians who spent the last 10 months advocating for this system in the next election. I think you're all going to lose, and a lot of you deserve it. Unless you move heaven and earth to try to make it right to the people of this city and fix the harm that you have collectively caused or at the very least failed to prevent. That's just my assessment. Let's go to Scott. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
It's fine in the sunshine and doing good. How about you, Adam?
Oh, you know.
Well, you know, I want to talk about the vaccines and the tragic job we're doing here in Canada. I mean, the U.S., obviously, way worse down there, but they've got 30% of the population vaccinated, and all the other modernized countries are in the same boat, you know, Britain and all that. We here, I mean, what are we at? 2% or less of our population is vaccinated right now against COVID?
I honestly don't know what our problem is. Like, I hear it, and I think that it has to be just critics of the government making it sound worse than it is. But then I look, and it's actually not great at all compared to all these other countries. What the heck's going on?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's like we're in a third world country here. I mean, Canada's
they're
rich.
Getting more than we are. The developing countries apparently have more vaccines in some cases, I read the other day.
Yeah, I mean, you open up everything like they're doing in the States, and you have drive-thrus. I mean, what does it take to get the vaccinated? They jab you in the arm for, what, 2 seconds? I mean, we should be up to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people a day. So, very disappointed. And now we've got the one shot, Johnson & Johnson. I think they just said, hey, we're going to do that. So that should make it easier because you don't need to get a second dose.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyways, just disappointed. I know people are always raving how great Canadian healthcare is, but, you know, in this case, definitely not.
No, I can't figure out how things are going so poorly, and I'm hoping that they resolve themselves very quickly, because I think that largely the initial response from the Government of Canada in terms of the CERB will make millions of Canadians very appreciative of the COVID response, and I think that'll go very well for the government in the coming election whenever that happens. On the other hand, the vaccine problem, it's the sort of thing that could sink all of that goodwill that was accumulated in the beginning of the pandemic. It needs to be fixed. It needs to be fixed soon, in my judgment.
Yeah, we've ordered way more doses, apparently, than we need, but that's not the point, right? We need the doses now, and to get it done, we shouldn't be sitting on it. Anyways, disappointed in that. The sun's shining. It's Friday. I'm happy.
All right.
Have a good weekend, Adam.
Have a good day, Scott. Appreciate it. 250-386-1161 *1070. Let's go next to Don. Hey, Don, you're on the air. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. Thanks. Yeah, good morning. As far as the vaccine in Canada, yeah, no, we are in a third world country, Adam. If you look at the numbers, and numbers don't lie. I think we have in British Columbia here about 1,376 deaths. In total.
I'd have to look it up with the... No. I meant Vancouver Island is what I looked at earlier today. I'm not sure about the... let me pull up the dashboard.
Yeah, that's what I pulled up anyway, Adam. It was about 1376. But I'd like to compare that with, say, Colorado and Costa Rica. Both places have a similar population, around 5 million. So Colorado, they suffered 6,066 deaths. And in Costa Rica, they suffered 2,829. Mm-hmm. So I think British Columbia should, what would you say, congratulate themselves as the people that participated in the wearing masks, keeping, you know, staying at home, not going to work, and so on and so forth, because I think we've done very well. I'll just say, not so much on the federal level when it comes to producing vaccines for the people. But I think it's the cost, Adam, of not being independent. And I hope Canada learns that it pays to invest in things like this to protect us, you know, prepare for the worst, hope for the best. Because now Canada looks like we're running around begging for vaccines, taking them from third world countries. It's kind of like robbing the food bank, in my opinion, Adam. So I'll leave it at that. So I kind of got a hunch we'll be through this before you know it. But it's something to reflect upon, you know, when we look at the future and where we put our money and energy. So anyway, Adam, have a great weekend.
You too, Don. Take care. 250-386-1161 *1070, a free call on your wireless device. Hi, Adam. A texter writes to me, I'm a health care worker and I just received my first dose this morning. I nearly cried. The texter writes, I was so proud of everyone working around the clock on this. They're trying our best and also living with all the pressures that COVID brings. Personally, we will get there. Oh, yeah, and we will. All I'm saying is that there's a lot of talk about a potential election in the air. And I have said, and I think, you know, everybody should be pretty much on the same page. The viability of any government during an election will hinge directly on how well the people have been cared for or not cared for prior to the election. Financially, I think the Government of Canada has done a huge amount to help millions of folks who would have otherwise been, well, would have suffered enormously, financially speaking. Many of us suffered anyway during the pandemic. What I am saying, though, is that people are creatures of, well, we're social creatures. We compare ourselves to our friends, to our neighbors, and when we see that we're doing worse than somebody else, we cannot help but feel either inadequate or that we're being failed or that we need to do better. You know, we want to be either on the same level as our neighbors, or sometimes we want to be a little better. We want to work hard. We're competitive in many cases. If Canadians have to go to the polls and all they see is newspaper headlines about how we're 54th place or whatever in terms of vaccination, that is not helpful for the electoral prospects of a ruling party. Now, the Liberals are doing well enough in the polls federally that they'd probably win a majority anyway, but it would not be an assured win like the type I think we would see once we get the vaccination issue squared away. So, it is what it is. Let's go next to Alan. Hey, Alan, you're on the air. How you doing?
Hi, Adam. How are you doing?
Well, here's the thing, Alan. I feel better now because I think that the people have a general understanding of the problems in the parks that I had in the summer and had to walk around carrying the burden of in the summer. And now all of you know why I was acting the way that I was. I'm frustrated and I'm angry that the powerful are still probably going to ice skate away from all this without a care in the world, without ever truly being held to account proportional to the risk that was subjected upon the or subjected to the good people of this city.
Right on. And but I want to talk to you about the little girl and the 50-year-old man.
Here's the thing, Alan. There are certain provisions that are in place with respect to legal proceedings that prohibit the transmission of certain facts and elements in the case.
No. I'm not saying that. Good. I was a social worker.
Okay.
In the 80s.
Let's have a general conversation about
yeah,
a 50...
Just a general conversation.
Let's imagine a general conversation. A 55-year-old man pleads guilty to invitation of sexual touching with a 7-year-old girl. This is our imagined, uncomfortable conversation that we're having.
Yeah,
all right.
I agree. I totally agree. But what they should do, if it was me, and I required that when I was a social worker, is that if you see something that is illegal, you phone the police and you phone a social worker, because that little girl may have to have therapy. And that's what I did that.
Mm. And that must have been very difficult work, Alan.
Oh, it was. Well, yeah, it was. Child abuse is just terrible. But did you know, now this is a general conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a lot of friends. I was in Fort St. John. I had a lot of friends down here.
Yeah.
Who were teachers.
Yeah.
And they would notice something, and there was no policy for those teachers to what procedures to do. And eventually, from what I understand, is that they did exactly the same thing. You phone a social worker, and you phone the police. A, it's illegal. B, if she's being abused by anybody, I don't care who it is, she might need therapy.
Oh, absolutely. She'll need therapy. Absolutely. Oh, anyone subjected to that would need therapy.
Absolutely. But those are the two. Now, I don't know if it's changed, but those are the two things we had. And at that time, if you did not report something that you see, and we'll call it just general child abuse, you would be charged because you saw something that was illegal, and it was that's what they did. And that's why the schools at that time had a policy on if a teacher saw something that was child abuse, even suspected child abuse.
Well, absolutely, it should be investigated. That's why we have police.
Yeah,
like these poor,
exactly.
Like I just.
It's a very hard thing, and
that
I understand that. But I just wanted to say, you know, like if I saw it, that's what I would do.
Absolutely. Alan, thank you for the call. And yeah, it is. Yeah, it absolutely is. I feel myself getting very angry at those who have subjected so many good people in this city knowingly to risk. Luck has been the best protector the people of this city have had during the pandemic. In my judgment, ladies and gentlemen, luck is the only reason that things are not far, 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 far worse than what we currently understand them to be. And yet, even that doesn't provide much comfort because our understanding of these situations tends to almost predictively trend in the same direction. In hindsight, the actions that the city takes always look a little worse in the long run than they did in the moment. And everything I say looks like it's just a little more true than it was in the moment. It's an interesting hypothetical scenario. What would happen if somebody in charge of everything constructed a deliberate set of events that would perfectly mirror what would otherwise be considered sensationalized right-wing stereotypes? Would we recognize what was happening? Or would we, saying literally what was happening, sound so much like what has been considered concocted, sensationalized, and stilted rhetoric? Would we be believed? It's a blind spot when you think about it. Why does anyone want to cause chaos for chaos's sake? I don't fully understand that. And yet, some human beings do. Heck, we saw it on Cook Street earlier this week. Someone, allegedly, of course, put a hose down a stairwell into a multi-unit residential building and apparently tried to flood it. Cam McIntyre with Ryan Price, March 3rd.
We received reports yesterday morning that two separate vehicles parked in the 100 block of Cook Street, one in a driveway, one on the street, were both damaged. They both had passenger side windows smashed out, one by a brick, another by a large rock. It's our understanding that nothing was stolen in any of these incidents, which is unusual.
In fact, I spoke with Wayne Holohan, and he was told that a coat was taken out of one of those cars and actually just left on the driveway. Somebody went through the trouble of removing it from the vehicle and they didn't walk away with it, left it on the ground.
When we look at the fact that the thefts from vehicle are a common occurrence, so we're just strictly mischief. Someone, it appears, intentionally trying to cause damage. And then shortly after that, same morning, yesterday morning, we received a report that someone had apparently intentionally flooded a basement of a multi-unit residential building. Again, all of these incidents occurring in the 100 block of Cook Street. So obviously raises concern for us that there's a number of incidents that appear to have occurred overnight that night. So we're wondering if there were other individuals in the area that were victimized. And of course, if anyone has surveillance video or witnessed anything suspicious, we would love to hear from them.
So there we go. Again, if you have any information on any of these events that we have discussed, and it's been one heck of a week in and around Beacon Hill Park. We had the mischiefs. We had a tragic case, a woman found dead literally on Dallas Road. And we talked with one of the people who found that woman at 6 o'clock in the morning the other day. Mar Gardner joined us and she was upset and distraught at the time. Then the next day, a fire, an individual inside dying, found dead, confirmed dead at the scene with a history that I think is illustrative of the flaws in the system itself that has allowed sheltering in and around Beacon Hill Park, raising questions as to how many others with histories that we don't actually know publicly can also be residing there beside the children's farm or perhaps 8 meters away from a playground. Quick break. News is next.